Okay, now it's time on the Wintrust Business Lunch to say hello to Elise Glink, the owner of Think Glink Media and Best Money Moves. Elise, thanks for joining us. How are you today?
I'm fine, thanks, John. I was thinking about how many billionaires there were back 30 years ago. A lot fewer than there are today.
By the way, you also have a new newsletter you can sign up for called glink.substack.com. It's your Think Glink newsletter, and you can get it at glink.substack.com or at thinklink.com. Well, what did I hear about billionaires? Somebody keeps track of them, right?
Oxfam, actually, which is a not-for-profit organization based in Great Britain, announced that there were 573 more billionaires in the world by March of 22 than 2 years earlier when the pandemic began, if you can imagine.
573 more billionaires in the 2 years of the pandemic.
That's right. It's amazing that a lot of that had to do with the stock market going up, but also different kinds of investments that they made. And what the organization said is that billionaires now collectively are worth $12.7 trillion. That is equal to about 14% of the global gross domestic product.
Global.
So you're talking about 600 people in the world who are worth 14% of the global gross domestic product, GDP.
Of everything.
And, of everything.
And what we hear is that while the rich are getting richer, the poor are getting poorer. When I think of Oxfam, I think of the poor. What did they say about that?
Yeah, they did. They said that 263 million people could be pushed into extreme levels of poverty this year. So there's an additional huge chunk of people. And they also take a look at things like, you know, how global warming is affecting people. Right now, there's a heat wave going on in India, and people are dealing with 121 plus degree heat every single day. So they look at a lot of different things. But that extreme of 263 million people versus, you know, maybe 600 billionaires is really something.
Yeah, no kidding. Wow. Okay. And do they pass judgment on that? I mean, you know, some of that is what the free and fair market does, and it's more complicated than that. But what do they say about that?
Well, I mean, they're really concerned. Obviously, Oxfam is a not-for-profit. They're an NGO, and they're really concerned about the people at the other end of the spectrum. Nobody's really that concerned about how many billionaires they are and whether or not they're going to have enough to eat. But on the other hand, people are very concerned about the fact that nearly a million people every 33 hours are being pushed into extreme levels of poverty. And what they mean by that is food prices, food that they can't afford, water that they don't have to drink, or they're being moved off of their land either because of deforestation in some places or violence in other places. And it's just interesting to sort of look at how the decades of progress that had been made against extreme poverty over the last two or three decades are now in reverse, a lot of which was put into motion because of the pandemic.
Elise Glink on the Wintrust Business Lunch joins us Mondays, and so here we are. You know, it's funny, Elise, we talk about all of the things, all the headwinds that the economy fights these days. A lot of the numbers are good. The markets aren't because of a variety of things. And when I heard that there's monkeypox, I thought, which of the seven plagues is left, for crying out loud?
Yes, I thought the same thing, John. Monkeypox just seemed like an unfair pylon.
Do we need that? Like, we've got cold weather, we got a war in Ukraine, we've got supply chain issues. Why not monkeypox too? Throw it in the mix.
Well, it's interesting. The Federal Reserve just has done a couple of different surveys, and they found that in 2021, at the end of 2021, just 24% of people thought the national economic conditions were good or excellent. And I think it's all of this stuff coming together for all of us. We're all just a little bit tired, and we just need to enjoy the summer for a bit.
Yeah. Well, I'm sorry. I'm looking at some of the things that we're fighting these days. And it seems like as good as some of the metrics are, you know, with interest rates and inflation, we're just not going to get over the hump right now.
No, we're not. And actually, it was interesting. So this week is Davos, right? And this is some of those billionaires we were talking about before the break are actually all together for the World Economic Forum, and the IMF managing director, Kristalina Georgieva, said that the global economy is facing its biggest test since World War II. And she outlined in her blog post about how when you start adding all of these things and piling on, so the Ukraine war, the pandemic, the volatility of the financial markets. I mean, today they're up a lot, as we've heard everybody talking about. And yet, oh gosh, last week, wow, what a disaster. It's, you know, 6-7 weeks in a row of prices dropping. And so all of these things together with food prices, mothers worrying about feeding their babies. I mean, when in this country did we ever worry about not having enough formula to meet the need? And yet here we are. Mm-hmm. People are really struggling. And so all of this stuff is mentally, I think, taking a really big toll. And if you're trying to buy a house, you're just about throwing up your hands because interest rates have jumped up over 2% over the last year, basically. And that's just overwhelming for a lot of people when you combine it with how fast home prices have also risen.
I'm trying to remember. I think interest rates are 2 points higher than they were since January, since, you know, the beginning of this year.
They started to go up. Last February, we saw 2.6%. Of course,
wow.
Today, a 30-year fixed rate, if you have the very best credit, is about 5.5. We're also seeing something new I should point out to our listeners, which is that when you go look for a loan, you might have seen an adjustable rate mortgage of 5.1, meaning it's fixed for 5 years, then it adjusts every year after that. But now I'm seeing 5/6 or 10/6. And I had to actually call one of my lender friends and say, what's up with that? Now what they're doing with adjustable rate loans is it's fixed for a period of time and then it adjusts every 6 months, not every year. And that is something new you got to watch for when you're going to apply for a loan.
Do you have numbers on how much people save if they do an ARM versus a fixed?
Yeah, it's interesting. Redfin took a comparison. Of course, it's interesting as they looked at a 30-year fixed rate loan at 5.3%. That's actually below where it is right now. That's how fast interest rates are moving. And they compared it to a 5.1 fixed for 5 years, then adjusts every year, adjustable rate mortgage at under 4%. So imagine that's gone up just a bit now. But the spread means you'll save several hundred dollars a month. You might even save several thousand dollars, depending on if you're buying down that interest rate. And you may save as much as $15,000 over the life of the loan.
Okay. Well, stay tuned for more news about all of that and numbers. Elise Glink also talks about them with Tom Fortino on WGN Radio Sundays at 6:30. You can subscribe to her newsletter as well at thinkglink.com. Okay, Elise, thanks for your time.
Hey, thank you, John.
That's Elise Glink. Jim Dahlke joins us regularly at this time, senior editor over at Chicago Inno. Hey, Jim, talk to me about the Players Trunk's appearance on Shark Tank.
Yeah, the Players Trunk, really interesting Chicago startup. Really, you know, this company was built before the NCAA name, image, and likeness rules, but has really sort of taken off since. So just as a quick refresher, these guys launched as a way for ex-college athletes to sell their game-worn gear. So think jerseys, think shoes, autographs, stuff like that. Then when the NCAA's NIL rules came about, it really opened up a brand-new revenue stream for these guys to sell stuff from current players. So current athletes can't sell their shoes because they're still on the court, still at school, but they can sell autographs, they can sell playing cards, they can sell T-shirts and hoodies and kind of branded gear that way. And so the Players Trunk is really a marketplace to sell stuff both from current and former athletes. And yeah, they headed into Shark Tank. So they were on Shark Tank on Friday. They went into the show asking for $650,000 for 5% equity. It was not enough skin in the game for the Sharks. Mark Cuban and Kevin Hart, who was the celebrity shark on the episode, went in on an offer for $650,000 for 30%. So a big, big up in equity there that the startup, I think rightfully so, turned down. So you see a lot of kind of what they call very sharky deals on that show where investors end up taking quite a bit of equity from these companies. I think they probably made a wise choice to not give up that much of their business and kind of go at it on their own and see what they can do. So I spoke to the founder last week They actually filmed this episode back in February of 2021, and they had to wait until about 3 weeks ago to know if they were ever going to make it onto the show. And actually, this was the season finale, so they were kind of sweating out if their episode was even going to air.
But it did, and boy, it's funny because the number that jumped out at us, I think you're right. I mean, I'll trust you. 30% equity in the company for $650,000 may be steep, but we were a little shocked that they were hoping to only have to give up 5% of the company. I mean, that seems to be too low. You'd think they could have found a number in the middle.
Yeah, they countered back at about 7.5, which, you know, if you've ever watched Shark Tank, you know that it's just not enough skin in the game typically for those sharks. So, yeah, they weren't really budging off that 30% number. And it's a good reminder that, you know, the venture backed startup world is not exactly as the Shark Tank episodes play out. The deals that happen on that show are not exactly indicative of the real world startup investing. And it's certainly great for exposure. I'm sure the show resulted in a lot of eyeballs for the Player's Trunk, as it does for just about every startup that joins that show and that program. But it doesn't always make the best business sense to give up about a third of your business.
Yeah, I know that. But boy, $650,000. I mean, that's $650,000, right?
That's right. Yeah. So, I mean, that's the way it works. And they're relatively haven't received a ton of funding. They've been backed by Starting Line, which is a venture fund here in Chicago, a little pre-seed funding, but otherwise have not gone out and done the big venture fundraise yet. So you imagine that maybe that's the next step for these guys.
Speaking of sports and startups, a Chicago golf startup is out there now. Who is this?
Yeah, so this is a company in Chicago called Stix Golf, STIX, and they raised $10 million the other week, really to create this direct-to-consumer golf club business. Really what they kind of set out to do is help golfers find quality clubs that don't break the bank. So their starter set comes in at about $700, which is their full set of clubs is about $700, which is more than what you would pay for kind of the basic starter set, but certainly about not nearly as much as you're going to pay for the name brand gear. So what they are finding is kind of the sweet spot in the middle for a new era of golfers out there. You know, the COVID pandemic really sort of was a big boost to the golf industry. About 25 million people played golf in the U.S. in 2020, which was up 2% and the largest net increase in nearly 20 years. And actually, new players were hitting the links in record numbers too, with about 3.2 million Americans playing golf on the course for the first time last year. So Stix Golf here in Chicago really believes that there's a market for quality clubs that don't break the bank.
Huh. So I wonder if the clubs are any good. Are they worth $700? Are any clubs worth $700? Are these like, you know, $5,000 clubs that were performed that well, but they're discounted? I wonder how good they are.
Yeah, I mean, they say that they're able to get the markdowns down. So, I mean, they're able to put together a quality set of clubs here. These are going to be a better set of clubs than your sort of off the rack, super, super cheap clubs that you can get as a starter set. They say they're able to kind of go direct to consumer and get the markdowns down and sell you a good set of clubs that you can afford. Although if you can't hit the ball straight, I'm not sure it's going to matter a whole much, right? So it kind of still depends a little bit on the skill set.
Oh, there's that. STIX in Chicago. Google is adding jobs in Chicago, right?
Yeah, that's right. So Google last week came out with a little bit of a Chicago report, kind of like on their office presence. And they said they hired 500 new employees across both of their offices in Chicago's Fulton Market neighborhood. That brings their total headcount here close to 2,000 workers, just over 1,800 now across their two buildings in the West Loop. And, you know, compare that to when Google came to Chicago 22 years ago, opened a small sales office here just with the two employees, and now headcount nearing 2,000. So pretty significant growth from Google. And, you know, it's not just a sales office here, right? They have people in their engineering, people who are working on Google search, on ads, their finance. Their second office they opened here is pretty much dedicated to their Google Cloud project. So some very tech-focused roles here in Chicago. Certainly, this is not just a sales outpost any longer. A lot of high-tech roles here from Google in Chicago.
Yeah, well, it'll take any kind of jobs, and those are usually pretty good ones over at Google. It's 12:42. Jim Dahlke is the senior editor at ChicagoInno.com. Talk again next week, Jim. We always appreciate your time.
Thanks, John.
It's 1243. More business news now. Here's Steve Grzanich.
Start your timer. It's time for the Wintrust Business Minute, sharing Chicago's business news of the day. The CEO of Abbott Laboratories has apologized for the company's role in the nationwide baby formula shortage. In an op-ed in the Washington Post, Robert Ford wrote, "We're sorry to every family we've let down since the voluntary recall exacerbated the nation's baby formula shortage." The recall started back in February when several infants fell ill after consuming Abbott formula. The FDA is investigating 4 hospitalizations and 2 deaths. Ford says the North Chicago-based company is taking steps to make sure shortages never happen again. The company says it's expanding production to increase supply, upgrading safety, and putting in place redundancies. Abbott's Michigan plant was recently cleared to reopen. A Chicago startup that designs technology-powered lending products for banks has secured $40 million in a new funding round. Amount previously raised $100 million in 2021 when it became a unicorn. According to Cranes, Amount has been focusing on helping banks finance buy now, pay later transactions, either directly to consumer or through retailers. Amount is a spinoff of Chicago-based online consumer lender Avant. I'm Steve Grzanich, and that's your Wintrust Business Minute.
We've got the business of food and Steve Alexander.
Yeah, we sure have been talking about beer a lot lately, haven't we, John?
Yes.
100th anniversary WGN beer. I've not had a chance to sample it. I understand that you have, and it's pretty good, huh?
Yeah, everybody's giving a thumbs up around here, and not just because we're here. I've heard from folks who aren't from here, and they like it, too.
Well, good. Well, let's have some more beer talk. In fact, today we're going to talk about deer beer.
Busch Light and John Deere are coming together to support America's farmers with limited edition John Deere and Busch Light for the farmers can.
That's Kristen Stowe, head of marketing for the Busch family brands. This is the second Busch beer targeted at farmers. For the last 2 years, the Busch Light cans have featured ears of corn, but this year, instead of corn on the For the Farmer cans, there is
a beautiful 8RX John Deere tractor on the front. So that is the tractor with the track instead of wheels.
And as with the corn can, there is a charitable component.
Yes. So we've been partnering with Farm Rescue for over 3 years now and have donated over $750,000 to Farm Rescue.
And Farm Rescue does things such as?
Think tornadoes, think flooding. Farm Rescue is able to swoop in and help, whether it's with harvesting, with sowing, and so forth. So for every case of Busch Light sold, we'll be donating $1 to Farm Rescue, and John Deere will also be matching our donation.
And one more thing, and this is a case of how words matter. As long as there have been green tractors and red tractors, there's been a mostly good-natured snarkiness between owners and fans of each. And after Busch tweeted that for each case of Deere beer sold, $1 would be donated to Farm Rescue, John Deere responded in a tweet, "Don't call it a case." And on social media over the weekend, a pack of the new Deere beer was smashed under the tracks of a huge red Case IH tractor. From the farm to your belly, today's National Taffy Day, which is made from boiled sugar and butter. That's the business of food and beer on 720 WGN.
Last week, we were telling you how McDonald's was pulling out of Russia. Amy Guth joins us now with another marquee company kind of doing the same. Hi, Amy.
That's exactly right. So now Starbucks has announced earlier today, they said that they will be pulling their 130 locations out of Russia. That accounts for about 1% of the company's annual revenue overall. They also said they're going to pay their nearly 2,000 Russian workers for about 6 months and help them transition to new jobs outside of Starbucks.
You know, everybody talks about how Putin thought he'd just be able to steamroll through. And I suppose not only is he getting a military wake-up call, but an economic one, because this war's been going on for a while, and only now is Starbucks saying that they're pulling out. My point being that had it gone swifter, maybe Starbucks would still be in, but the losses keep mounting, don't they?
Yeah, that's exactly right. I wouldn't be surprised if we saw some other companies that are making these kinds of decisions after, you know, being shuttered temporarily. What the question for me now is we saw McDonald's, we saw a buyer come forward to buy those numerous locations in McDonald's. There was far more than Starbucks has, nearly 850 McDonald's locations. So what I'm curious about is what will become of those Starbucks locations? Are they looking for a single buyer? Will that be one buyer? Will they be sold off separately? separately, but I'm sure it's a similar strategy once a place is outfitted for a restaurant type operation for any kind of food and beverage. It makes the most sense to try to sell it as the same type of location. So I think that'll be very interesting to see what happens there. Of course, McDonald's has had a lot of trouble with the trademark issue. You and I talked earlier about how very quickly we saw a lot of trademark applications being filed for other names like McDuck and Uncle Vanya's and things like that as McDonald's was pulling out of that. So we'll see what happens with Starbucks trademark and as well as their locations.
6 months of pay for the displaced workers. Last year was the best ever for retail sales in Chicago. Is that right?
Yeah. I thought this was really interesting reporting from Albie Galoon over at Crain's Chicago Business. So it kind of makes sense when you think about pent-up demand. A lot of people were at home in 2020. Those who could generally were working from home. And then in 2021, we saw some real major numbers coming in. So according to Melifini and Associates, which is a local consulting firm, Albie Galoon reported that retail sales in the Chicago area jumped to $52.5 billion last year. That is 28.6% over 2020. And that's also the biggest annual increase since that firm started tracking local retail sales. So that's a pretty big number when you think about that. We saw an 8.7% drop in 2020. We saw those sales kind of rebound. What they're predicting, though, is that sales only increasing about 6-8% this year. And part of that is higher prices will kind of account for some of that rise. So it'll be inflation will kind of make those numbers look better than they actually are, right? Because higher prices mean consumers will have less money to spend. So still another increase this year, not quite that whopper of an increase like the jump from 2020 to 2021, but really interesting reporting around that.
Twitter is upping its game on suppressing misinformation.
That's right. So this is a project that actually started prior to Russia invading Ukraine, but certainly it is very relevant for that. So Twitter's now going to start applying warning labels, and they're going to stop recommending, algorithmic-wise, they're going to stop recommending content that has claims, any kind of misinformation, things that have not or cannot be vetted, anything that's been flagged as misinformation, especially during fast-moving times of crisis. So any kind of time where we're looking at a military conflict, a natural disaster, anything like that, you'll start to see these. The tweet will essentially be kind of hidden behind a little bit of a warning. So if you can still proceed, it won't be taken off the site. You can still proceed, but you will have to acknowledge, this has been, this is misleading information. This has been vetted and it's not credible. You'll see that kind of warning. And so to determine whether claims are misleading, Twitter's head of safety and integrity wrote in a blog post that they're going to require verification from multiple credible, publicly available sources, including evidence from conflict monitoring groups, humanitarian organizations, open source investigations, journalists, and so on.
They say this is surrounding armed conflicts and other crises. So has there been a lot of misinformation out of Ukraine and Russia on Twitter?
Certainly. Yeah, there's really been a lot. From some of it is kind of inadvertent misinformation, where there's a random video of something that someone suddenly claims this happened in Ukraine and it can't be verified that it happened, or maybe later it turns out that it happened somewhere else a long time ago, something like that. We see that a lot with photos. There was also some very targeted, purposeful misinformation and disinformation campaigns, one of which said that President Zelensky had died by suicide at one point, and that was inaccurate. So things like that are especially when you're talking about, quickly moving stories where safe safety is really paramount. These sort of labels will start appearing on tweets. We've seen a little bit of that around politics. We've seen some little warnings around COVID misinformation, but these are going to start moving towards military conflict and natural disasters and things like that. We see anytime there's a big story and news is moving fast, there's always, the opportunity for misinformation to happen. Some of it is perfectly innocent. Someone just wants to share something they saw that they found really compelling. But a lot of times we do see these, really targeted mis and disinformation campaigns infiltrating those news cycles on social media and being shared widely.
Sometimes you see people and they're doing that and you think if you had just for 1 minute did a Google search on the thing you're sharing, you'd know it wasn't true. We will visit later this week. Thank you, Amy.
Sounds good. Thanks so much, John.
Amy Guth on the Wintrust Business Lunch.